Let's go to San Francisco, where the flowers grow so very high. It's time for the SAFTAcast. I'm your host, Scott C. A couple days off the mark on the release on this one, but it is here now, and it is live in your ears. Episode 39 with our special guest, Kaya Oakes, today on the program. Lots of good stuff to talk about there, but lots of good stuff to also talk about with what's coming up with the SAFTAcast. Every now and then, we like to update you on what's going on with the program here. What's going on right now is that around the country, the leaves are turning color. They are starting to fall, and speaking of fall, that brings with it a multitude of holidays, including Halloween, Thanksgiving, and then a whole slew of them in December. The SAFTAcast has a great number of episodes coming at you here in October and November, but then in December, you know, we got a lot of positive response last year to our depressing Christmas music episode. So this year, we are actually going to do two holiday-themed episodes. But here's the problem. There's so many possible topics that we could cover at that time of the year that we don't even know where to go. So we're going to solicit ideas from you, the listener, by going to our Facebook page or on our Twitter. You can voice your opinion. What should the SAFTAcast cover in December? We got to start taking ideas now, you know, because we got to start planning out the shows, how we're going to do them and everything. We might even put together a little poll of some of the more popular ideas that we've heard through our various channels and such that you might want us to do. Look for that on our Facebook page. And to find us on Facebook, it's very easy. All you do is log into Facebook, type SAFTAcast into the search bar at the top of your page, and you can find us. Go there, like us, and you can get updated information about the program, as well as voice your opinion and make comments on each episode if you'd like, and even ask a future guest a question when we open that up and ask you for questions. Now, that was really awkward of me to say, but nonetheless, you know what I'm trying to say. You can also find us on Twitter at SAFTAcast. We also post the occasional photo of the show's mascot, unofficially mascot, the SAFTAcat. So yes, there are cute pictures of cats every now and then on the program. You can also find us on iTunes. We are indeed coming off of there, and you can rate us and review us there. Thanks to all those of you who have rated us and reviewed us in the past. We appreciate it. And you can do the same too, my friend listener. All you have to do is just go into iTunes and look us up in the store there under podcasts and give us your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you in all the myriad of ways that there are. And speaking of hearing from people, today you are going to hear from the one and the only Kaya Oakes. It is a great interview and truly an honor to have her on the program. It was truly a grand time to sit with her and chat, and as you will soon discover, we have our own particular favorites when it comes to airports, and some of our lesser favorite airports, and some we just absolutely despise around the world and in the nation. We also talk about indie culture, why moving sucks, and much, much more. All of that is coming at you in just a moment, because first, as always, is a little rockin' theme song. Hey, Kaya. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry, I'm mid-coughing spasm. Sorry. I have that cruddy cold that's going around. I don't know if you guys are getting it in Florida yet.
No, there is a bit of a stomach bug going around down here, though.
Ugh, that's so much worse.
I agree. I'd rather have just a cough and a sneeze than a stomach bug in any direction.
Yeah, exactly. That is misery. I had really brutal food poisoning a couple years ago, and I never want to go through that again. It's horrible.
I totally understand. I'm paranoid about food poisoning in the house, especially when it comes to raw chicken. I just, you know, deep clean everything every time.
Yeah, that's smart.
So I'm going to kick this off with the burning question that is on everybody's mind right now. Planes, trains, and automobiles. Which is the most elegant form of travel?
Well, trains, obviously. And when you get to sit down and have that lovely rocking motion of a train, it is very elegant. Cars, no. Airplanes, the lowest form of travel, sheer misery, and just the opposite of elegant, just depressing.
Have planes ever been elegant travel?
Probably before I was born. People who are older will tell you that once upon a time, people dressed up to fly, and the flights were spacious and you had room to stretch out, but I have no memories of that. I just felt like a sardine every time.
Do you remember the first time you ever flew on a plane?
Yes, I do.
What was the experience like for you?
It was very exotic. We were, as a family, we drove everywhere. We took road trips a lot, and flying was a very strange sensation. It's due to just the kind of the motion of moving but not feeling like you're moving. I remember feeling very confused by that. But it went by really fast, and that was pretty crazy too, just how fast you go from one place to another.
Was it a short flight?
Yeah, it was like 3 hours.
Okay, so a little longer than a commuter, but not necessarily cross country.
Right, it was from Vancouver to the Bay Area, so not so long.
Does flying get easier as you get older and the more experience you have? Or do you still get nervous when you fly?
I don't get nervous. I hate going through security, and I hate delays and cancellations. Once I don't get worried about getting on the plane. I don't worry about it's so much safer than driving. I'm a really nervous driver and passenger. But on an airplane, I just kind of zone out. Once I'm on the plane, I'm fine. I just hate airports. And so I will do everything I can to avoid having connections, and having to go to multiple airports.
If possible, I will always get a direct flight.
Yes.
I'd rather deal with two airports than four.
Yes, absolutely. Anything to get around that hop, 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 because the more air connections you have, the more the odds are you're going to get stuck somewhere. And it's usually in Chicago. So, and I like Chicago, but I do not like either of the airports there.
Do you consider Chicago to be the worst one that you go regularly through?
I regularly go through either Midway or O'Hare, and they're both awful. And yeah, they're both pretty bad, although Atlanta is a nightmare too, and JFK is really bad. I have to give thumbs up to San Francisco Airport, even though I live here, and of course I'm going to be biased, but it's clean, it's spacious, the terminals are not, smashed up against other people in the terminals. You can actually kind of spread out a little bit, and it has really good food.
Yeah, I found Atlanta is problematic because the terminals are spaced apart, and you land, and it's like you have 15 minutes to get across 17 miles of tarmac.
Oh yeah, and then in Europe there's the nightmare of Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, where you have to take a bus from one terminal to another. It's so bad. It's so bad.
Sounds like Philly's airport.
Oh, really?
I'm always stuck going to the E terminal where you have to take the outdoor tram in the middle of winter to get to. At
Oh, no. That's just cruel.
least Atlanta has underground trams.
Right. But Atlanta, I mean, they don't really have the same kind of winter you have in Philly. And so it's not, it gets cold there, but it's not like that.
Sometimes you see the most amazing things in airport, though. When I was going through Philly one time for Christmas, I saw a guy dressed as Santa Claus. I don't know how I got through security, but there was Santa right there for me.
God, I don't know what's the weirdest thing I've ever seen in an airport. I was on a flight with, okay, probably the weirdest thing was I was on a flight with the members of a band who were one of the bands that was like a reality show on MTV. They used to have these MTV shows where they would, create a band on a reality show, and then the band would have to go on tour, and it was a girl group. And I only recognized them because I had happened to see the show one night when I had insomnia, and I'm like, they're on my plane. And it was a Southwest flight, so the cheapest airline. They got there late, and they had to sit all the way back by the toilets. So there you go. That was the most interesting sight I've had on a flight. And then recently, when I flew to LA, the lieutenant governor of California was on my flight, but he's not really a celebrity. And yet, people were taking selfies with him. So.
Can't imagine what it's like to be semi-popular or popular and be on a plane. I just want to sit back and ignore all of you people.
Yeah, it doesn't sound. I mean, I just like. He was being very nice. He used to be the mayor of San Francisco, and people do know who he is because when he was the mayor of San Francisco, he was the one who pushed through marriage equality, and so he was sort of a national celebrity at that point in time, and good for him. But like once, it was a flight to LA, so it's 50 minutes, you know, it's super short flight, and people were still going up to him on the plane, you know, to talk to him. It's just like, oh my gosh, we're not even up in the air yet. People are going, can I talk to you about my kid's school?
How long is the flight from San Francisco to Los Angeles? You say 50 minutes. Is that 50 minutes in the air or 50 minutes total?
No, in the air. It's between 50 minutes and an hour, but getting to and from airports on either end, it's about 3 hours, you know. But LA is huge, so like wherever you go, it's gonna take forever to get there once you get off the plane.
So I'm wondering if it's cheaper, if it's easier to drive from San Francisco to Los Angeles.
Apparently they did an episode of Mythbusters about that, which I haven't seen, where they timed it, and it's 4 to 5 hours driving depending on traffic and 3 to 4 hours flying. So it's almost the same.
And there's no point unless you're rich.
No. If you had a private plane, it would be wonderful. But we're supposed to get high-speed rail between LA and the Bay Area in the next like 10 to 20 years. So once that happens, I think a lot of people will choose that instead.
How long have you been in the Bay Area?
My whole life, with a short breaks, I lived in Seattle for a while, and I lived in Olympia, Washington. I went to the Evergreen State College up there, and I lived briefly in Europe. But this has been my base for most of my life.
So you're native of the Bay?
Yeah, and my folks are from here, too.
So it is home, then. It's comfort.
Yeah, absolutely. I really love it here. It's getting very expensive, but, you know, you figure out a way to make it work. And I feel very in tune with this place, which I did not in Seattle, although I like Seattle. Seattle is different in a lot of ways and had a hard time acclimating up there.
What is it about San Francisco, about the Bay, that makes you say that, you know, the culture feels right for me here?
The diversity, you know, and the landscape. You can be outside pretty much all year, and I'm not like an outdoorsy person by any means, but I like the fact that the climate is such that you can go out and walk around, you know, pretty much 365 days a year. And friends of mine who live in the Northeast are like, no, you can't really do that for a good few months in a row. So that's part of it. And then I just think people here they're pretty laid back, and people make fun of us for that, you know, the way we talk. But it is true that generally people they're not very aggro, and I appreciate that. It makes it like my teaching life a lot more pleasant, because most of my students are also from California, so they fit right in.
So the stereotype of San Francisco as being really hippie-like and such is not exactly true, but kind of is?
Kind of. There's still a lot of that in the culture, even though the boomer generation is, you know, they're aging. Like, the people who went through the 60s are still around. They've mostly moved to the East Bay, which is where I live, Berkeley, in particular, has a lot of old aging hippies. But yeah, I mean, we definitely have our kind of cliche things. There's like lots of organic food and lots of medical marijuana outlets and stuff like that. But, you know, it's what's going on right now with the tech industry is sort of taking over a lot of San Francisco. And as a result of that, some of that more hippie granola stuff is getting pushed out.
By the hipsters.
Right, exactly.
Makes me wonder what it'll be like in about 10 years.
Who knows? Because that stuff could implode at any time, which would be really bad for a lot of people. But we had the dot-com thing about 10 years ago that just tanked. And then things kind of went back to normal. But the Bay Area is a history. It's a gold rush town. San Francisco has had this whole repeated history of people sort of quote-unquote discovering it. And then taking it over, and then something happens, and they leave. And so 10 years from now, it could be nobody knows. So that's kind of keeps it interesting. Like, it's always changing, which is kind of fascinating from a sociological point of view.
It's like a town of fast money, or quick, easy money, but not like Vegas easy money.
Right. People do definitely strike it rich in California, but I would not be one of those people. So I definitely don't know what that's like.
Well, you can continue to dream.
Yeah,
we all can. Boy, so the culture there has to be absolutely fascinating. Is that why you came back, or were there just it was time to come home in a way?
There were things I liked about the Northwest, and I've got family up there, too, in Portland, and I go up and visit, you know. But when I was ready to leave, I was ready to leave. It's very gray a lot of the year. You know, the cliche about Seattle is that it never stops raining, and it turns out to be true. And it gets dark a lot earlier because it's higher, you know, closer to the Arctic Circle. So like where it'll get dark here at 6, it's already dark there at 5. And it aggravated just kind of this propensity to be sulky. And so I was ready to go after 2 years up there. Actually, less than 2 years. It was enough.
We can see why grunge came out of there.
Yeah, and I was living there around that time because I was there in the late 80s, early 90s. So the kind of nihilistic grunge movement was very big when I was living in Seattle. While it was fun to see a lot of those bands, on the other hand, people were just really kind of depressed and drunk as a result of that a lot of the time.
It reminds me of the line on The Simpsons, making teenagers depressed is like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're there at that time. I hate to get into the writing aspect and everything, but I also know that one of your big books, and it was recommended to me, is you are considered to be a bit of a guru on indie culture.
Well, yeah, a few years ago I was. It's changed a lot since then. And at the time, when I wrote that book, I was, like many people in the literary world, running an independent magazine or helping to run, collectively run independent magazine that was an arts and culture magazine. And it blossomed, an article I wrote for that blossomed into that book that I wrote. But subsequently, the indie label just came to kind of mean nothing, you know. It was really quickly co-opted by people who didn't understand the roots of it, and that was part of why I wanted to write the book, was to, you know, correct some of the assumptions people had that indie just meant skinny pants or like a certain haircut or a certain band that you liked or Coachella or whatever. That it actually had this long history. And anyway, so I write the book, and then like it comes out, and then I just completely lost interest in writing about indie stuff. I was like, I'm done. I spent 3 years working on that book, and I'm so sick of it. And thankfully, I got interested in other things pretty quickly. So there you go. But what I do miss about that was the stuff that came before the book, the working with other people on on as helping run a nonprofit arts organization that put on art shows and music shows and stuff like that. Like, that kind of work I think is really valuable, and I'm really glad people are still doing it, and I try to support it as much as I can.
Yeah, it's still pretty big scene out there, the indie publishing scene and indie records as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a teenager in the 90s at that time, and I got the sense that indie culture just meant independent of major outlets like major labels or major production companies, but it also felt a bit shallow to me. Like, it was cynical in a way, and maybe the cynicism in me starts early. I thought, okay, it's indie, but they're still being backed by big names.
Right. And that happened, you know, pretty quickly too, that indie got discovered. And that these like record labels would go from being truly independent to being a subsidiary of Warner Brothers or something like that. And then publishers too, you know, a lot of independent publishers are imprints of big publishers, but that's a survival mechanism. It's just like, we're not going to be able to do this on our own anymore. But there's a kind of, I don't know what the right word is. There's a kind of, there was in the 90s, around the mid 90s, there was a kind of preciousness about indie, like, oh, we're cooler than everybody else because we're indie. And I was self-aware of that even while being within that scene, kind of. Like, I used to always say to the other people I worked on the magazine with, like, why don't we have writers of color? Why don't we have writers who don't have MFAs, you know? Like, we need to really diversify because we're just in this niche. And it was hard. It was really hard to break out of that niche.
Indie culture then was not truly indie then. It was basically an elitist group, a small group.
Yeah, exactly. And that was something I thought about even as part of that elitist group of, and I have an MFA myself, you know. Just the fact that it was a lot of people who were writing and talking about and playing music for and making art for other people like them. And so that was kind of frustrating to me because I've always been interested in you know, crossing borders and work that crosses borders. But it's the same problem that there was and probably still is in the poetry world with only other people who write poetry read poetry, and that, you know, that's makes it harder to get books out of that circle, and it becomes this kind of insider thing. So, yeah, that tends to happen with art movements, unfortunately.
Is there really an indie culture today even? Because I'm thinking, before we started talking, I started thinking, with all the streaming services available, with music, streaming, video streaming, can there even be an indie culture now, or is every one of us our own indie culture?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think you're onto something. I mean, this idea now that, like, people just curate everything and they personalize everything to their particular tastes. I mean, I use streaming music and I have the weirdest playlists, but I think they're the weirdest playlists because that I want to think I'm different, but who knows? Somebody else probably has Vivaldi and Kendrick Lamar back to back, you know? It's just that I'm making my own kind of thing, and the internet mirrors that too, with the way we can make our Facebook or Twitter or whatever, or Instagram, you know, a list of people who we follow who are like us, you know, or who appeal to our aesthetics. That this idea we don't need these kind of gatekeepers that indie presses and record labels and magazines were in the 90s. They were gatekeepers who allowed people into things to help them discover them, but also kept people out, frankly.
Yeah, culture has become so fragmented now. There's so much available. Every one of us has our own, okay, here's my list of fandoms, and here's my levels for each one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I spend a lot of time, because I'm doing a lot more journalism these days, and I spend a lot of time on Twitter because it's a really good way to follow breaking news stories. And in fact, before they break, you know, in the media. But I keep everything in lists. So I've got, you know, writers and then like writers who write about the subjects I write about. And then writers who write about this other thing that I'm interested in, but I don't write about. And I'm like, everybody I'm following is a fucking writer. Like, why haven't I got anybody on here who's not a writer or an academic? And I got to break out of that. But yeah, that's just how it worked out.
Start following some of your favorite movie stars.
Okay, I will. I don't know who I like, though. I'm like, oh, you just said that. And I'm like, movie stars, who do I like? Okay, I'm blanking out.
When I joined Twitter, that was the first thing I did was, okay, who am I going to follow? Okay, my significant other, a couple other friends, and okay, let's go to my favorite TV show.
Yeah, totally. I think that's what a lot of it is. It's like I can sort of like get, quote unquote, get close to celebrity, you know, Twitter appeals to us, like, because we can get close to what celebrities are thinking in an uncensored way. But of course, it's not them usually running their own Twitters. It's some poor unpaid intern getting a degree at USC or something like that.
That's why I go for the low-level celebrities, the C-level and D-level, because they are writing their own.
There you go. So, yeah. Yeah, like I follow, what's his name from Firefly, Nathan Fillion. And I think that's actually him.
There are a couple out there.
Yeah.
Cher does her own.
Yes, and she's very unfiltered, which I appreciate. Can't spell, though.
Drives us English majors up the wall.
Yes.
Yeah, it feels like we're all kind of indie in our own way now, in a weird way. But yet, there's still that corporate element to it, you know? Yay, I enjoy this, this, and this, but they're all run by Hulu, which is a subsidiary of Universal. Or NBC, I forget who they're under now.
Right, right. And the same is true in book publishing, too, you know, that, like, everything's an imprint of something else. And that's, again, publishers had to do that to survive. I get it. But it's like that kind of sense of like, or in comic books too, you know, that comics became, they kind of got lumped together in, you know, like it's an imprint of Marvel, or it's basically always Marvel and DC. And then they just kind of spawned their little sub imprints. But what we think of as independent is really, again, it's consumer independence. It's like, I have the freedom to buy these things, you know, rather than creative independence, which is, let me make this thing independently and nobody's going to pay me to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then maybe I will barter it rather than selling it. That to me feels like the last kind of authentic way to do it.
Yeah, I've wondered in the past, I've speculated about why the record industry went so hard after MP3s, and my theory was because finally the consumer for the first time really had choice on their side.
And that's dangerous. And also, frankly, it was no longer being beholden to buy 10 tracks of an album when 5 of them are filler. You know, or they're kind of like the B-sides, that olden days when we had 7 inches and you'd get the B-side and it was just crap. Now you could just buy one song or even just download one song. And the record industry, they were completely freaked out by that and they waited too long to deal with it and it really hurt them.
Yeah, there was a really good movie recently made by Alex Winter, Fanboy of Bill and Ted. He did a really good one about Napster, the rise and fall of it.
Huh, interesting. Is it on Netflix?
I believe it is, actually.
Okay, cool.
It's a pretty fair and balanced film.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Looking at it, there's really no bad guy here. It's just a clusterfuck of bad things happening and people.
Yeah, there's one that I show in class. It's called Good Copy, Bad Copy, which is about piracy. And like how piracy in other countries like Brazil, and Russia is kind of no big deal. Like in Africa, like copyright doesn't really exist, and so they don't get like why it's bad to pirate things, you know? Like it's not considered to be bad. And so this whole notion of like who controls what we're listening to, again, it goes back to like times when corporations were kind of flailing, and like they looked the other way when MP3s came out, and while they were looking the other way and trying to keep people buying CDs, all this stuff sprouted up, and by then it was like a hydra and you couldn't control it. So I'm there, it's just like nobody's really a good guy or bad guy. The only thing that sucks is that artists had to figure out other ways to make money. But some of them seem to have figured it out.
Some. I often tell since I'm like, no, you don't understand. The music industry is the most soulless corporation on the planet. Even worse than movies. They are evil.
Yeah, it's true. And there's a lot of exploitation of artists or like backing musicians, you know what I mean? People who play on a track, and in the old days they could make a decent living off royalties, you know, if they got a songwriting credit or, but now it's just because of the Spotify thing of not paying people very much. And it's really curious that the person who took a stand about this was Taylor Swift, you know? Somebody who didn't need to take a stand because she doesn't need the money was the one to stand up and say, like, you need to pay people more, so.
Again, it's going to be interesting. I think in some ways with what's happening now with streaming, nobody really knows what to do yet and how to deal with it.
Right. It's true. Pandora is headquartered here in the Bay Area, and they have been since they started, and they were one of the first, I think, streaming radio services. And I don't know how much artists get from being played on there, but when Pandora started, and probably still today, a lot of the people who worked for them were musicians. Were indie musicians, in fact, like in indie bands or on indie labels, and saw that as the potential for like a cool new way to get their music out there. Oh, I don't know how long they've been around now. It's been a while, actually. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if those people like regret that decision, or it'd be interesting to do a sort of follow-up with some of the original employees.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see where we're at and where we're going with it. Just nobody really knows yet how to deal with this.
Right, and that's true of so many things because technology is advancing so quickly that people can't keep up with it enough to kind of like see where things are going to be in X number of years.
I just know I'm not going back.
Well, vinyl made a comeback, so, and now there was a funny article a friend posted on Facebook that cassettes were going to make a comeback, and I'm like, God, no, they're so terrible. They're always breaking, you know, and they were, the sound quality was awful, so I don't want to go back to cassettes.
I don't either. I just got rid of mine. I don't want to have to go get them again.
Yeah, I bought a new car last year, and it has a CD player, but I never use it. I just play stuff through my phone. We still have a couple big music stores in Berkeley near where I teach, and I do try to go in there and buy stuff to support the stores because they're independently owned, and like a lot of musicians work there. You know, it's like it's a job that those people need, and so if they can keep the doors open, good for them. So once in a while, I'll go in and buy a CD or a record. I do have a turntable set up. I don't use it very often, but sometimes for the nostalgia, it's kind of nice.
I'm not going back and getting a Walkman, though. I'm happy with them. I'm happy having all these songs on one device I don't have to worry about. No commercials.
Yeah. No, Walkman. They were just terrible. They were terrible.
And I love YouTube. Oh, do I?
YouTube is frankly a great research tool, you know, for either my students use it for research papers. They can find interviews with experts. They can find commercials to analyze, you know. I can use it too for the same things when I'm writing things. I can use YouTube for research purposes. And frankly, it's good for killing time.
It's the first time travel device. You put it on and an hour goes by and you're like, oh crap, I have to go to work. I've traveled in time. Neat.
Totally.
I just wonder when the MLA is going to get around to finally making a citation for streaming media.
You know, they finally, I think it was just a couple years ago that they had citations for social media finally showed up, you know, way behind when they should have. So when my students go to cite YouTube videos, it's, yeah, you're right. There is no specific formatting for that website. So it's a pain in the butt.
Yeah, last year they finally got around to making one for Twitter.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's great. You know, Twitter, you can contact authors, and some students have in my classes. But now I'm like, they're like, how do I cite YouTube? I'm like, recorded TV or movie, best I got.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all still figuring it out, too. You know, academia tends to be a few years behind technology-wise, but MLA tends to be even further behind than that. So,
but Wikipedia is not bad. Just don't think of it as the be-all, end-all of research.
Right. I always just say, use the footnotes. Use the citations, not the Wikipedia page itself, because those actually go to sources. So,
unless the stakes are low, like you want to know some dumb thing about pop culture, Wikipedia is great.
Right, there you go.
I play a game with them. I show them, I bring up Robot, and I'm like, okay, here's all the knowledge about Robot. Now let's look at Optimus Prime. And Optimus Prime is four times the length. Like, yeah, it's got a slant, it's got a bias, but... If you just want to know how transatlantic cable worked, great. You're not going to write a paper.
Yeah.
Just curiosity, man. Great thing. But,
yeah.
We got to get with the times, us academia. That's my call to you people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get with it. So now, you mentioned a moment ago about some of the music tastes. I got to ask you, because I'm just curious, what's on your playlist these days? What are you listening to right now?
Well, I just moved, and my commute is 1/4 as long, thank God. And so when I'm not commuting as much, I'm not listening to as much music. But in the last couple of years, so I wrote the indie book, and then I got really sick of, in the process of writing that, I got completely burnt out on rock music and like did not want to listen to it ever again. And so I took a break from that for like a whole year and listened to nothing but Baroque classical music. It was like I needed to like clean my brain. And so I got really into Vivaldi and Bach and early music like medieval chants and Gregorian chants and stuff like that. And then I got kind of tired of that after about a year and a half or 2 years. And then so I went circled back around to where I was in terms of my musical taste evolution when I was in college, which was sort of the golden age of hip-hop, you know, and a lot of this really fabulous hip-hop music was coming out in the 90s, and started listening to hip-hop again. And so that's, I'm sort of toggling now between Baroque music and hip-hop. So that's the two extremes. And my tastes in hip-hop are pretty... they're pretty eclectic. Like, I don't like the mainstream, the kind of, like, I don't like the Drake kind of stuff, but I love Kendrick Lamar. I think he's just brilliant, and I was really lucky to get to write a little bit about him recently. So like I'm sort of in that weird in between place.
There's got to be a mashup out there of Baroque chamber music and hip hop. There has to be.
Yeah, I bet there is. Yeah.
Has to be. But you just moved recently?
Yeah, I moved from the suburbs of Oakland back into Oakland. So San Francisco is the major metropolitan city, but it's very small. It's actually only 7 by 7 miles. So it's really tiny and very densely populated and very, very expensive. It's Manhattan, basically. And then there's Oakland, which is across the bay, which is about 500,000 people. And then outside of Oakland, there's the whole rest of the East Bay. So there's like a dozen cities, maybe. So I was living in Richmond, California, which is So it goes Oakland, Berkeley, El Cerrito, Richmond. So it's four cities away. So it's about half an hour away from Oakland. Yeah, so it's the burbs.
So not a huge move in terms of distance necessarily.
No. But much more convenient. Like I said, my commute's right. It's 10 minutes now to work from, it was about 45. So it's much easier.
What was the most stressful part of moving? I just moved myself, my wife and I.
Oh, you did.
And it was only a few buildings away we moved. So it was not very far,
less
than a city block, but still extremely stressful. What is so stressful about moving?
Just like the confrontation with how much shit you own and like the self-loathing that comes out of that of like, why do I own so much stuff and how did I get this? We had just moved 2 years ago. So it was like, all of a sudden, like, here's all this stuff that I thought we got rid of last time and it's still here. I think that's the most stressful part. I mean, finding a place to live is really hard too, at least here. It's very competitive. But yeah, after that, like, just that thing of like, where is all this going to go? And why do we have so much stuff? What was it like for you? What was the hardest part?
I think it was really finding a place. Our situation was weird, and so we had to bug out pretty quickly and find a new place. And where we are, the rates are not good, and it's not much availability at this time of the year. So the actual packing is pretty easy. I think the biggest problem is, as writers, we have like 60-plus boxes of books.
Yeah. I pared down a lot the last time we moved, and my friends were horrified. They're like, you gave away 2,000 books. And I'm like, yes, I did, because I just can't have that burden anymore of holding on to books. So I came up with three categories. Am I going to read it again? Am I going to use it as reference? And would I loan it to somebody? And if it didn't fulfill one of those three, I got rid of it and I donated all of them to this place in El Cerrito called the El Cerrito Free Bookstore, where basically you can walk in and drop off books and walk out with books, and they just exist on donations. It's great.
We're doing the same thing. We finally did our first purge as a married couple, and about 1/7, 1/8 of our collection out. We joked it was like terminate with extreme prejudice.
Exactly. You really have to, because otherwise you're just going to be carrying them around. And then, you know, you're 50, you're 60 on up, and you still get the same. For those of us who are in that economic class where we're probably not going to be able to buy a place for a while, you really have to think that you'll probably move again, right? Like at some point in time. And so I just try to think like, how much of this do I absolutely need, and just pare down like that.
Exactly. It's like, okay, I've had this book for 5 years. I always meant to read it. Never did. Maybe hold on to it, but probably not.
Yeah. And I do the library so much more now, really lean on the library to avoid just impulse buying, you know, walk into a bookstore and buy something just because I'm in a bookstore.
That's the hardest part of being a writer.
I know.
You go to a reading and you're like, I must buy all the books of all the readers here now.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. But it's also compulsive.
AWP is a nightmare for us writers sometimes.
You know, I went last year to Seattle, and I didn't bring home any books. I did not. And it was a deliberate thing. Like, I'm going to go to the book fair and look for people, but, like, that's it. I'm not going to buy anything. And it kind of was a shitty thing to do to other writers, but it was like, I can't, I know I'm going to be moving, you know, I can't do this. And people are always handing you things anyway at AWP, brochures, chapbooks, you know, broadsides, etc. Like, tote bags, I came home with 4 tote bags.
Wow, only 4? I grabbed 8 this year. Last day, they're like, we have tote bags if you did not get one. And I'm like, all the tote bags for me.
Yeah, totally. And it's just so much just junk. And at some point it was like, well, if I get books on top of this, this is just going to get ridiculous. So I was very deliberate, and I am going to go next year to AWP in LA, and I have the same strategy, which is not to bring home any books.
I go into AWP, I think, with like a target of like, there are two books that I will buy
mm-hmm.
that I specifically know about. But that's it. Anything
yeah.
else? Bonus nachos. But beyond that, no.
That's pretty smart.
I don't know many writers that can do that kind of stuff like you or I. Just, everybody I know walks away with, I have 200 pounds of books. How am I going to do this?
I just got sick of it. And I've got a bad neck, you know, so if I carry a really heavy bag, it hurts. So there's the physical thing, too. Like, I just can't do this. So... yeah, one time I went to New York and I went to the Strand and I bought like way too many books and I had to ship them home. And I just thought, this is just fucking ridiculous. I'm not going to do this again. So I just don't go to the Strand.
Mental note, if I ever go back to, next time I'm in New York, don't go to the Strand.
No, don't do it. It's so bad.
I'll spend my money elsewhere. As much as I like the Strand, I'll get a good cup of coffee.
There you go.
It's pretty crazy. Now, I think that is the most stressful is the books. And you're right, finding all the shit you own. But you do get, it's almost wonderful. And sometimes you're like, holy crap, I still own that? Neat.
Yeah, I found a box that I had put in the back of a closet. And it had in it all of the posable action figures that I collected when I was working at a comic book store. So, like, which I worked at 25 years ago. So it was like Nightcrawler and all these Gundams, you know. I was, when manga was first getting popular, and so they would get these Gundam figurines that, you know, you could transform and stuff. And there was like 20 of them in this box. And I'm like, why did I keep these? But they're really cool, right? And I had totally forgotten I'd hold on to them.
So you were in the comic book stores in Iran. That must have been around the time of like X-Men, the animated series, 92, 90, thereabouts?
Yeah, I worked at a comic book store from 93 to 94. And then I worked for Viz Comics, which is a manga publisher, for 2 years, and I wrote for their magazine. I had a column, and they published like Ranma was their big one, and then they later went on and they were the first, I think they were the first US publisher for all the Sailor Moon stuff. So yeah, but I was not a big fan of the Japanese stuff. I wasn't an otaku like all the people I worked with, so. But it was pretty fun, nonetheless. It was a fun time to work in comic books.
Well, they're finally getting legitimacy in the academic community, too. And,
yeah, I've been teaching graphic novels for years. And in fact, I'm teaching, starting next week, my students are reading and writing about Gene Yang's American Born Chinese, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I became obsessed over the last year, circling back to another topic, Ed Pisker's The Family Tree of Hip Hop, telling the early roots of hip hop and doing it in early 80s Marvel style.
Nice.
With
yeah.
the yellowed pages, offset printing on certain panels. It's gorgeous to me.
Cool. There's definitely, I need to catch up with the new stuff. I'm so far behind on comics right now, but we're lucky to have at least, I think, 3 comic book stores in the East Bay, one of which is big, you know, that has a lot of underground stuff and back issues and so on and so forth. So that's great.
I'm not a big comics person, but I do enjoy more graphic novels now. I've started to refine that love of it.
Yeah, it's a great narrative form, and students enjoy writing about it because it's visual and textual analysis. Go break them out of that, you know, that just analyzing text kind of thing.
They don't realize they're actually learning.
It's a sneak attack.
Ha! It's like, watch this YouTube video for credit. What? Okay.
Yeah, totally.
So much fun nowadays. There's so much fun. I don't know why people don't take advantage of this in the classroom. So much good stuff to play with now.
Yeah, totally. There really is.
I use bad lip readings in Comp 1.
To help people figure out when their sentences are unclear.
That's part of it, but I hadn't thought of that. I think more in terms of like, all right, here, you want to understand Kairos? Let's look at bad lip reading for a moment.
That's great.
You know, when does this come out? Look at the upload date.
Yeah, totally.
There's a lot of fun going on. Okay, I was asked, while I had you here, I have to ask about your tattoos.
Yeah, I have one bird. The rest are native California flowers. I have, oh gosh, 1, 2, 3. I think, hear me counting and like losing track. But they are all on my arms and upper body. I don't have any below the waist, which is a deliberate decision. I just kind of wanted to confine them because otherwise they get out of control. And I started with some oak leaves, California live oak trees, since that's my family's name. And then I added a bunch more. And so I will try to get one only now. I'm going to be 45 in a few months. And so I'm not going to stop getting them because that's ridiculous. But I try to only get one when I have a major life accomplishment, like publishing a book or something like that. And so most recent one I got earlier this year when I finished the manuscript. And then the one before that I got when my last book came out 3 years ago. So I've slowed down a little bit. But yeah, they're large and colorful, and they used to attract attention. Now everybody has them, so I don't stand out as much as I did 10, 15 years ago.
Why so many of the flowers? Is it just a California love?
Yeah, I really like the landscape here, and I really like particularly the Northern California landscape, and particularly the coastside landscape. And I just, I have like a wild iris tattoo on my arm, and I just really, my husband and I spend a lot of time up in southern Mendocino County when we're not here in the Bay Area, and I just really love that part of the country. Like I said earlier, I'm not an outdoorsy person. Like, I don't go hiking all the time or anything like that. But I enjoy nature, and I resonate with it. So, yeah, I just really like the way they look, too, frankly. And I'm lucky to have a couple of friends who are really talented tattoo artists. Not that they work for free, but that I am able to go to them with an idea and they can conceptualize it.
What are you thinking for the next one? Any thoughts so far?
I have to write another book before I earn another tattoo. But the one I got this year is actually the first one I've gotten that's not organic. It's a Latin phrase that I came across some years ago when I was studying early monasticism and particularly hermits. I got really interested in learning about hermits. For some reason, I just find people who are hermits fascinating. And I read this phrase from the guy who founded basically monasticism in the West. And it's a Latin word, and it says quies, quies, like quiet, but with a T. And instead of meaning shut up and be quiet, it was a word that he used to describe this ideal state of mind, which is, it's almost kind of Buddhist, the idea that when leisure that is occupied in activity that is tranquil, so that when you're busy, you know, your mind doesn't start racing. So I thought that would be a good good reminder to have somewhere on my body. So it's on my arm, and it's a little bit crooked, which doesn't bother me at all.
I think that adds to the charm, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Can't be perfect. It sounds like the concept of mindfulness, yeah, the Buddhist concept.
It is very Buddhist, and so because I'm interested in interfaith, you know, stuff and spirituality and religion, like that was the most recent tattoo I got. And I have a friend who's a monk. He was not a monk a couple years ago. He ran off and became a monk, and I said, I'm going to get this idea from Saint Bruno tattooed on my arm, and he's like, "Oh, well, that's a great idea." So I got a thumbs up on it from
you
a monk.
You have approval.
Yeah.
What would make someone just say, "That's it, I'm leaving and I'm going off to be a monk or a nun"?
Well, in his case, it was something he'd been thinking about for a while. But, you know, he was interested in the solitude and the contemplation and the meditation. And, yeah, he's drawn to that kind of stuff. As an artist, one of those people who's very, what's the word, introverted, you know. So he's finished his first year, and he's doing great. It suits him very well, but it was something he thought about for, like, many years before he went.
Yeah, I can't see it being a rash decision.
They wouldn't take you if you just ran off to a monastery. They'd turn you away.
You must have a deep commitment.
Yeah.
Prove it.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're almost out of time.
Yeah, I know.
I know. It goes by so fast here, and I still feel like there's so much to talk to you about. but before we let you go, you have a new book out right now.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? Where can the folks find it?
You can find it on the internet. The ebook will be out. My publisher puts the print book out first, and then the ebook comes out at the end of the month. So you can get the print book now from any retailer of your choice. And it is an exploration of the idea that more and more people are becoming religiously unaffiliated, and what that means in the sense of they're interested in religion, but they're not interested in participating in it, and what that means for the future of religion. So basically, it's about DIY religion. So a lot of people mix and match different religious traditions. You remember what we were talking about earlier about curating and how we're all doing that with our music and our videos and stuff. Now people are doing that with their religions. And wow. I think it's fascinating. So I spent a year interviewing people and doing research, but mostly interviewing people about their own stories. And so it's a kind of mix of interviews and research, but again, mostly interviews. And it's very journalistic, very literary journalistic. And yeah, so there you go. That's what it's about.
That's awesome. So where can the folks find you online? You said you're pretty active on Twitter these days.
Yeah, I'm just at Kaya Oakes, KayaOakes on Twitter. I have a Facebook author page where I post things that I've written and upcoming events and stuff. And that's also KayaOakes, but with a space in between. And then I have a website, a brand new website, freshly redesigned, which looks great. And it's Oakestown, OakesTown.org. And that's my web home.
And of course, you're also on Wikipedia. I think you might be the first guest on this program that has an official Wikipedia page.
Yeah, and I didn't make it. I swear to God, I did not make it. I did have a friend who asked me if I wanted one, and she put up the first version, but it's been edited by all these random people who I don't know. So I'm like, thank you, random people. It's really out of date, though. So if any random Wikipedia editors happen to hear this, please go update my Wikipedia page for me. So.
As long as the information's correct and accurate, I don't care.
I don't even care about that. They can write whatever they want. Really out of date. So.
Did you know that Kaya Oakes is a proponent of speedwalking?
Yeah, I would like it if it was just crazy made-up shit. You know, like she's got a red nose that's 3 feet long and sprouts a long tail when there's a full moon. Like, fine.
She can lift multiple car windows with a single arm.
Yeah. So anyway, yes. So yeah, I do have a Wikipedia, and I have a Tumblr, which I don't update very often. I'm not on Instagram. Maybe someday. So there you go.
Now the kids today, they seem to like the Instagram. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not a big photography person, so it's not my thing.
Kaya, it has been a pleasure chatting with
you. Likewise, Scott. It's great to talk to you. Give my best to your BFF.
I shall indeed.
Okay.
Hey.
And yeah, thanks. It was great.
Oh, take care. Have a good evening and rest yourself there. And because I know you've been on the road and you probably have a lot more to go. Ben.
Yeah, I'm going to Nebraska next week, so.
I don't know whether to say congrats or my sympathies. I haven't been there, so I won't make a judgment.
We will find out.
All right. Well, you have a good evening. You okay. Take time and relax for yourself.
Thanks a lot. You too.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.